Hi, it's Robin Young. Thank you for listening to Here and Now. There are thousands of podcasts out there. You chose this one. It's your thing. Listening choices are part of who you are. And the choice to support your favorite NPR program is yours, too. Visit donate.npr.org/now to donate to your station. Then share why that's the kind of person you are. Tweet or create a public Facebook post with the hashtag WhyPublicRadio.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And Republicans are predicting that by next week, they'll have the votes needed to pass their final version of a tax code overhaul that would cut corporate tax rates permanently, individual tax rates temporarily. The plan, largely hammered out behind closed doors, also scales back some popular deductions such as state and local property taxes, mortgage interest. And there's still some horse trading going on. NPR congressional reporter Kelsey Snell joins us to tell us what's in it. Hi, Kelsey.
Hi there.
So talk first about these generous tax cuts to corporations, smaller temporary tax breaks to individuals. As written, the corporate tax rate would drop from the 39% or so to 21%. Now, both sides of the aisle wanted a drop on this, but there's still some horse trading just among the Republicans on how much. And talk about why the tax breaks are temporary on individuals. That's from 39.6, I think, to 37. This is for the wealthiest earners. So, you know, talk about the horse trading still going on, maybe in the corporate tax, and why the temporary on the individual?
Sure. Well, I think it's important to note that there's general horse trading altogether because we don't have a final bill yet. What we have is Republicans came out yesterday and said that they have an agreement to that they're calling an agreement in principle. They have some details have been hashed out, particularly the corporate rate, as you mentioned, would be dropped. The top rate would be dropped from 35% to 21%. That is a little bit of a change from what the White House originally said they wanted. They were originally looking for a 20% rate, but it looks like it got bumped up just a little bit to help pay for some tax breaks in other places. Mm-hmm. On the individual side, as you mentioned, the top rate would go from 39.6 under the plan to 37%. We don't know exactly which taxpayers this would hit, but we do know it would be the top wealthiest people. The temporary nature of some of these tax breaks might be a little bit misleading because Republicans tell me that they expect that Congress will decide sometime in the future that they don't want these tax breaks to expire. No Congress likes to be in charge when they are seen as increasing taxes, which is what letting these lower tax rates expire would feel like to people who are paying taxes. But they had to set them up this way to make sure that they fit into strict Senate budget rules. So it's a little bit misleading to say that they are definitely temporary, but in the bill, that's how they're structured.
Okay. What about the so-called pass-through corporations? This is where profits pass through to business owners who then have to declare them on their individual tax returns. Republicans wanted a deduction here. What happened there?
Yeah, so it looks like they are heading in the direction of satisfying the specific Republicans who were calling for more generous breaks for these pass-throughs. Those people are like Senator Steve Daines of Montana and Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin. They wanted to make sure that small businesses were treated more like corporations under the new tax bill. We don't know exactly what that will look like, but I spoke with Senator Johnson yesterday. He said he hasn't quite decided how he'll vote on it. He's waiting to see the final bill, but he was pleased with the way the discussion was going.
Okay. There was a proposal in earlier versions to phase out deductions for state and local property taxes. And this was especially a sticking a point for Republicans in wealthier states with higher taxes. So what happened there?
Yeah. So they, as far as we can tell, in my conversations with congressional aides who are working on this bill, the plan is to set a cap of $10,000 on state and local taxes. And people could kind of pick and choose and do a little bit of choose your own adventure on how you fill up that bucket. So if you live in a state with really high property taxes, maybe you take up all $10,000 of that with property taxes. Or maybe you're not a homeowner, but you live in a state that has very high sales taxes or income taxes. You could write those off and kind of do pick and choose as you like.
Yeah. The grad school tuition will not be taxed as income. That was a big sticking point. Some deductions for medical expenses, we hear, will still be allowed. The standard deduction will be effectively doubled for individuals. Getting rid of the mandate in Obamacare is still, we understand, in this plan.
Right.
But the version makes it easier to allow drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And there are some other controversial measures like allowing tax-exempt organizations such as churches to endorse candidates. Are those still in?
Yes, we don't know the status of what is known as the Johnson Amendment. That's the one that deals with tax-exempt organizations. The House legislation that passed would have repealed the Johnson Amendment, would have made it so these tax-exempt organizations could do political work. The Senate bill doesn't address it, and that's not something that we've heard a final decision on. In terms of drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, we do know that that will still be in the bill. What it would do is it would loosen restrictions and make it easier for oil and gas drilling in some parts of that reserve in Alaska.
You've got Republican senators like Bob Corker concerned about the deficit this will produce. Susan Collins of Maine wants some health care guarantees in place if that, fine for people who don't buy health insurance, is done away with. Is there a sense in the few seconds we have this is going to be scored before debate begins on Monday?
Well, they do have to have a score before it can be voted on in the Senate, but we don't know exactly the timing. We also don't know the exact timing of the vote. It could push off into Tuesday or Wednesday at this point. But so far as we know, the support seems to be there. Republicans I spoke to are confident that this will pass.
And we're also hearing that John McCain, who has been ailing, his supporters feel he will be able to be there for the vote. So we will watch. Kelsey Snell, NPR congressional reporter, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, 5 years ago today, 20 first graders and 6 adults were killed at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. 20-year-old Adam Lanza carried out this slaughter using 3 semi-automatic firearms, a rifle, and 2 handguns. Following the shooting, Connecticut enacted some of the toughest gun laws in the country. Lori Mack from member station WNPR in Hartford reports on the impact these laws have had.
In the wake of the Sandy Hook shooting, Connecticut lawmakers made sweeping changes to the state's gun laws in 2013. For starters, they broadened the scope of what the state classifies as assault weapons, banning more than 150 gun models, including the Bushmaster XM15 Lanza used in the shooting. Mike Higgins, co-owner of the gun shop TGS Outdoors in Brantford, Connecticut, demonstrates features on a weapon banned for civilian sale, though he can legally sell this gun only to the military and law enforcement.
Some of these are a collapsible folding stock, right? Pistol grip, detachable box magazine. If this had a flash hider, that's another one of the features.
The legislation also bans the sale of gun magazines with a capacity of more than 10 rounds. A permit is now required to buy any type of gun or ammunition. The state also has a registry of deadly weapon offenders and a universal background check system. Has it made a difference? Ron Pinciero, executive director of Connecticut Against Gun Violence, thinks so.
If you look at the homicide rate, I think it worked out to that there were 92 gun homicides per year in Connecticut on average. Last year, 2016, there were 53.
That's the lowest homicide rate ever, according to state data. And Connecticut has one of the lowest gun death rates in the nation. But the tightened laws don't seem to have hurt gun sales all that much. According to state police records, roughly 135,000 guns were sold in 2016, up from 127,000 in 2012. And nearly 30,000 gun permits were issued in 2016, the highest number in the last 5 years. But thanks to strict permit laws, Mike Lawler, Connecticut's Undersecretary for Criminal Justice Policy and Planning, says the state knows exactly who those permit holders are.
It's about 250,000 people in our state of 3.7 million inhabitants. And so it's a relatively small minority who are law-abiding citizens who have guns. And the right to own guns is protected by our state constitution. And as long as people act responsibly, they'll be able to enjoy that right for as long as they choose to.
But not all states have background checks as comprehensive as Connecticut's. Gun store owner Mike Higgins supports a federal bill that could help address that, the so-called Fix Nix Act, the bipartisan legislation aimed at strengthening the national instant criminal background check system.
To make sure that there is proper reporting through all law enforcement and mental health channels to make sure that the Nix system is as effective as it possibly can be. And I think that would do a great deal in making truly an effective change.
Gun owner Peggy Crisio of East Haven agrees. She was issued a gun permit within the last year, owns a pistol and a rifle, and uses them for sport and protection. And she has no problem with Connecticut's stringent gun laws, including the ban on certain gun models.
Because I'm not interested in using those type of guns. I'm interested in protecting myself. I'm interested in protecting my family. I am for stricter background checks. If it takes another month or two or three to get a gun, well, what's the hurry? Really?
But some gun owners have expressed frustration. Higgins says several of his customers feel unfairly treated by politicians.
I think what bothers me is they sometimes take a look at gun owners or gun store owners and think that we don't have emotions and we don't think about these things. We do. I mean, I think we all want to have a safe world for our children. You know, maybe how we go about these things, we think of it differently. But in the end, we all want the same thing.
But gun violence prevention advocates, as they like to be called, might disagree. Ron Pinciero from Connecticut Against Gun Violence says that while the group got most of what it wanted as far as gun legislation, he wanted to go further.
The one thing, as far as what we did get that we didn't get completely, was we wanted all assault weapons removed from the state immediately upon passage of the bill.
The problem is that government can't take property without giving compensation. And, he says, the state certainly wasn't going to pay for all the guns they'd have to take. For Here and Now, I'm Laurie Mack in Hartford.
A report published today says executions and death sentences remained near historic lows in 2017. According to the Death Penalty Information Center, the 23 executions and 39 projected death sentences this year were the second fewest in more than 25 years. Joining us now is Robert Dunham, Executive Director of the Death Penalty Information Center. He's with us from Washington. Robert, why are executions and death sentences near historic lows?
Well, I think what we're seeing is the continuation of the long-term trend. Support for the death penalty in the U.S. Has been fading since the 1990s. And during that period, we saw more than 300 death sentences a year. And we also saw 98 executions. So the poll this year from Gallup showed that public support for the death penalty had dropped to 55%, and that was the lowest in 45 years. Death sentences are at the lowest in 45 years apart from last year, and executions are at a generational low. So I think it's a continuation of a long-term trend.
And public support matters here because the public's not deciding whether somebody gets the death penalty or not.
Well, in a sense, they are, because what we see is that the public is who serves on juries. And when you have the highest level of opposition to the death penalty in 45 years and the lowest support for the death penalty, those are the folks who are going to be sitting on juries. Since 2000, we've had seven states abolish the death penalty. That means that there are going to be fewer states who are pursuing it. But even within the states, fewer counties are pursuing the death penalty. And what I think is really striking is when we take a look at the county figures, 80% of the counties in the United States don't have anybody on death row. 85% of the counties have never executed anybody, at least in the modern era. And 99% of the counties in the United States didn't impose any death sentences at all last year. So we're really looking at a practice that's become more and more geographically isolated. And in fact, and this may be taking statistics almost to minutia, but in 99.9% of the counties in the United States, this was a record low year for imposing death sentences, only 27 death sentences in 99.9% of the counties. Three outlier counties contributed 31% of all the death sentences in the United States. And without Riverside, California, Clark County, Nevada, and Maricopa, Arizona, this would have been a record low year.
Well, and here's another statistic. Nearly 75% of the executions took place in just four states. Which states are those?
The trend that we've seen in the United States is that although the death penalty is on the books in 31 states, it's carried out by very few. So there were eight states that carried out executions this year. Most of them are concentrated in the South. And that's been the case historically. Over the last 5 years, Texas, Alabama, and Florida have executed more people, and Georgia have executed more people than anybody else. Alabama is also involved in the executions. And so we have this narrow geographic area in which death sentences are being imposed, and also a narrow geographic area in which they're being carried out. Most of the United States isn't executing anybody. Most of the United States isn't sentencing anyone to death.
Now, you mentioned public opinion as one reason why there are fewer executions going on right now. Another issue that we've talked about before is the drugs that sometimes have to be used in these executions. They're
perhaps ineffective, sometimes hard for states to get. And then the other issue is that there are some people who we find out later didn't do it, shouldn't have been executed, and states are worried about that.
That's right. And it's a range of factors that have driven down support for the death penalty. I think the exonerations are very interesting this year. There were four more people exonerated from death row in 2017, bringing the national total up to 160. And those cases illustrate some of the problems that we see with the death penalty and that we've been concerned about for a long time. Questions about race discrimination, questions about ineffective representation and prosecutorial misconduct and junk science. One of the most controversial of the exonerations this year was the case of Rodriguez Crawford in Caddo Parish, Louisiana. And your listeners might remember that Caddo Parish was the county in which Prosecutor Dale Cox had said, "We're not killing enough people." And it turns out that in Rodriguez Crawford's case, his child died of sepsis, of pneumonia. And the autopsy showed that there was sepsis in both of his lungs. And all of the competent medical experts who've looked at the autopsy have concluded that this was not a murder at all. This was a baby who had been ill and who died of natural causes. Cox had just lost a death penalty trial in which he had attempted to get the death penalty against another young African-American man for the death of a child. And he wrote in an internal memo that he thought Rodriguez Crawford was somebody who should suffer as much pain as possible before he dies. Essentially, the county went after an innocent man and put an innocent man on death row. It's not the first time it happened in Caddo Parish, and the parish has had an extensive history of race discrimination in the application of its laws, particularly the death penalty.
Do you see a day soon when there will be no death penalty in the United States?
I think the numbers are telling us that the use of the death penalty is going to continue to remain low. It doesn't tell us whether the death penalty is going to end. But we are seeing it being used less and less by fewer and fewer counties in fewer and fewer states. Ultimately, that suggests that it's a punishment whose time has passed, but I think it's going to be up to the United States Supreme Court to determine whether it's going to go away.
Do you expect that'll happen soon?
There have been a number of cases that have raised questions about the unconstitutionality of the death penalty. The court so far hasn't reached out to grab them. The court's been taking cases about individual practices that it thinks are outside the mainstream.
That's Robert Dunham, who's executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center, and we'll link you to their report out today at hereandnow.org. Robert, thank you.
Thank you for having me back.
92 countries have submitted movies to the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences this year for consideration as best foreign language film. That's a record for the category. Film critic Andrew Lapin has this look at some of the early contenders.
Imagine if the Olympics only accepted one athlete per country, and that instead of sending their best athlete, each nation chose the one they thought Americans would like the best. That's the Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film in a nutshell. It's been a competitive award since 1956, and it's rewarded to the country instead of the filmmakers.
So we're here to do the best foreign film.
From Iran, The Salesman, directed by Asghar Farhadi.
For the past 2 months, a committee has been screening movies from 92 countries in an effort to narrow down this parade of nations to 9 finalists. Those 9 films will be announced by the end of this week, and the final 5 nominees will follow in January. Despite the long odds, more countries keep entering the competition. This year, there are 6 new contestants, including Syria. The documentary Little Gandhi is about Syrian peace activist Giyath Mahtar, who was tortured and killed by the government in 2011. The film's director, Sam Khadi, said he made Little Gandhi under harrowing circumstances. In one scene, an interview with 2 activists in the city of Daraya keeps getting interrupted by distant gunfire. For Oscar, Little Gandhi is what we might call a long-shot bid. It's from a country in turmoil, after all, and it doesn't have a major American distributor campaigning on its behalf. We're probably more likely to see a nominee like France's entry, BPM, about the founding of the French chapter of the ACT UP AIDS activist movement. The one scene, the heroes storm a school and demand to know why the principal isn't distributing condoms to students. BPM puts you right in the middle of a passionate movement to save lives. And it's a safe bet to make the shortlist, because it's French. 82% of the Oscars in this category have gone to European films. So maybe we should welcome the American celebrities who want to teach us more about the world, like Angelina Jolie, who directed Cambodia's submission, First They Killed My Father, a biopic of former child soldier Luong Ung. And in the Swedish film The Square, a scathing satire about the art world, American Elizabeth Moss plays an English-language supporting role as a journalist. In one scene, she asks a respected art museum's publicist to explain a pamphlet promoting a new exhibition.
Yeah, do you mind if I read this to you?
Please do.
Yeah. May 30, 31. Exhibition, non-exhibition. An evening conversation that explores the dynamics of the exhibitable and the construction of publicness in the spirit of Robert Smithson's sight, non-sight. From non-sight to sight, from non-exhibition to exhibition, what is the topos of exhibition, non-exhibition in the crowded moments of mega-exhibition?
All right, that pretentious gibberish is supposed to be funny. But is it any crazier than thinking a brash, cynical, dark comedy like The Square has anything in common with a gay rights historical drama or a documentary shot in a war zone? And that's the big problem with this category. It convinces people that foreign films are their own weird breed. But this year, one submission might break out of the pack and make history.
Habla una amiga de Orlando. Yo soy...
Sí, sí, sé quién es.
¿Qué pasa es que Orlando se empezó a sentir pésimo?
Chile is entering the drama A Fantastic Woman, starring Daniela Vega as a transgender woman whose life is thrown into chaos when her older lover dies and she has to contend with his grieving, prejudiced family. The film's distributor, Sony Pictures Classics, will also push Vega for Best Actress, which would make her the first Oscar-nominated trans actor. If that happened, maybe we wouldn't have to call A Fantastic Woman a foreign film. It would just be a film. For Here and Now, I'm Andrew Lapin.
A famed radio voice will exit the stage on Friday. After 30 years at WFAN in New York, Mike Francesa will sign off. Listeners will miss his combative conversations with them, his rants about everyone. Here he is a few weeks ago railing at the New York Giants and head coach Ben McAdoo, the Giants in the middle of a really bad season.
I got to ask you, coach, what would embarrass you if you're not embarrassed by what you've seen the last 2 weeks?
Okay, that went on for 13 minutes, and the Giants eventually fired McAdoo. Connection. Mike Pesca is Here Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com, and joins us from WBEZ in Chicago, where he'll be hosting Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me this weekend. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
So you say this is a big deal. I agree. I listen. But did Francesa have influence on teams or on other broadcasters? I mean, why the big deal?
Oh, yes. Francesa was right, wasn't he, about Ben McAdoo? And it all came to being. He was the conscience of a city. And there was a time when the columnist did that. So, you know, my analysis of his importance is that he spanned a couple eras, from when print was important to when the internet was important. But he, and for a long time, him and his partner, Christopher Mad Dog Russo, They were the conscience of the city. They were the voice of the fan. Sometimes they used that for ill in an unfair, bullying, or inaccurate way. But a lot of times, and owners would listen, and decision makers and GMs would listen, it's where the decision makers got a sense of the pulse of what the fans were thinking. And theirs is a for-profit business. So people would fire coaches or make trades or not make trades, or at least know that they had to handle the Mike Francesa reaction. So that's the answer about his influence on sports. Really influential, especially in New York.
And what about on broadcasting? Because he had this wild style.
Yeah. That's the thing. Elvis didn't invent rock and roll. You know, Bill Haley and Rocket 88 did. But, man, Elvis popularized it. So Mike Francesa comes along in the last year of the 80s. There's this new format, sports talk radio. They pair him with Christopher Russo, who I said called the Mad Dog. Mike was the smart guy. The Mad Dog was, as can be imagined based on his nickname, the crazy guy. And they blow up. And they're the number one show in New York. And they're the most money-making show on all radio. And for a time, sports talk talk radio was not the most listened to format. It's close to this now. The most remunerative format it was, because their demographic, which are men 25 to 64, kind of hard to reach, and they love to listen to sports talk radio. So every city has one or two. Some cities have more. Crazy cities have sports talk radio. He didn't invent the format, but without his early success, the entire landscape would be different.
I just have to say, and I think you'd agree, that, oh, people like Chuck Berry and some other African-American artists invented rock and roll, but we're just going to move on. Let's just listen to a little more of Mike Francesa.
Sal in Brooklyn. What's up, Sal?
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
Good. What's happening?
Did Michael K. call you to thank you? So now maybe he has a shot to win in the top slot now that you're leaving?
No, I somehow he forgot.
But okay. You know, first of all, here are my drive, New Yorkers. But that's talking about his rivalry with broadcaster Michael Kay, who's on ESPN Radio. Look, how much is WFAN going to take a hit when he goes?
Well, as Francesa ranted, he's beaten Michael Kay in the book for 48 straight years or 48 straight books. Give me a break. Michael Kay won for a month. They're going to miss him. They're replacing him with a triumvirate, including Bart Scott, who doesn't really have any New York ties. He's a former athlete. They'll see what they could do. Yeah. The guy's in the Broadcasting Hall of Fame. He'll be doing something interesting. They'll miss him for sure.
Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst, host of the Daily Podcast, The Gist, and hear him on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me this weekend. Mike, thanks.
Thank you.
On Monday, the website Eater reported allegations of sexual harassment against celebrity chef Mario Batali. Batali said, "Sounds like me." Then Tuesday, workers at Ken Friedman's Spotted Pig in New York accused him of being the pig, groping them, sticking his tongue in their mouths. Friedman said some of the charges were not true, but apologized for others. Google chefs behaving badly, and you'll find the chef at the Star Inn, one of Britain's best, arrested for allegedly setting a worker's pants on fire with a blowtorch and beating him with a rolling pin over failed broccoli, then lowering another worker into the broccoli soup. That kind of cutthroat environment, truly there are knives, is celebrated on Gordon Ramsay's Hell's Kitchen.
What in the f*** is going on here? What is going on? You, do me a big favor.
Yes, chef.
Yeah? Get your apron off, get packed, and f*** off out. First, get out! Get out!
Yes, chef.
Who's next?
Let's bring in Amy Brandwine, chef and owner of Centralina in Washington, D.C., noted for its all-female management team and huge presence of women in the kitchen. Amy, we know you can't comment on these individual cases, but this is the culture, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, yes. It is a physical job by nature of the job that chefs do in the kitchen. And I think that those elements kind of play into some of the problems that are going on.
Yeah. Have you ever had experiences of sexual harassment or the kind of bullying or physical harassment we're hearing about in kitchens?
I think, have I been sexually harassed, meaning somebody who had a position of power over me, somebody who was my superior, who was asking me to do sexual things? No. Is sexual harassment necessarily just your boss? No. It's your fellow coworkers, how they're treating you. And so that's pervasive in the industry.
What, and you've had to work, as most women in the industry have, you know, thinking of people like Jody Adams or Barbara Lynch, you know, people who were early women in kitchens. You've had to work alongside men. And you've talked about how you feel you've had to take a different approach to them in order for them to accept you.
Yeah, I mean, when I started out in the industry, I think one thing I was really careful about was just being as straight as I could be as far as my own femininity. So, you know, the way that you present yourself in your private life, you try to not maybe do all that in the kitchen. It can be a distraction, which is not fair, but any kind of, like, sort of science of sexuality can encourage those types of behaviors.
That's once again, it puts the onus on the woman to sort of shroud herself, which isn't hard in a kitchen given the, you know, the big aprons that you have to wear. But I hear what you're saying. Having been in a lot of kitchens, you are cheek to jowl. It is hot and it is pressured. You know, Barbara Lynch, a tough cookie in her own right. She was a bookie when she was a kid in South Boston. But now she's like a, you know, she's like a chewy cookie, a cookie with a soft center with her own staff, because she says Todd English, famed chef and owner, taught her how not to have a restaurant. She says when she worked for him, he dumped a bowl of pasta on her head once, threw a Coke bottle at her. He has denied that. But others have spoken of not just his behavior, but other behavior. You know, what are the pressures in the kitchen that might trigger something in someone who might be predisposed to that kind of behavior?
You know, what are the triggers? I don't think there's one thing that you can say is a trigger. And I think that's what is so important to remember. It can be anything. It can just be some guy that wants to blow off steam. It can be the line cook who you're trying to tell them to do something and they respond to you in a very sexual way. A lot of these things are power issues. You know, they're not sex issues. A lot of them are reinforcing the male stereotype. Some of it is just joking around, meaning how men joke when they're by themselves. It's sort of like being on a football team.
Will you talk about them being a football team? You know, we hear about, you know, there's, you know, drinking, drug use, this banter that might be in a locker room, in the kitchens. Why so much smoking on the part of chefs? Is that also stress?
Yeah, it's stress. Yeah, it's drinking and stress.
That's great insight into, you know, how the culture behaves. And I'm going to rush to say, not the whole culture. I got to spend some time with Patrick O'Connell at the Inn at Little Washington. He's known as the Pope of American cuisine because his goal as a chef, he says, is to heal people. And his kitchen was so calm. His sous chef has actually his sleeve caught on fire. And I witnessed this. Patrick said, "I believe your sleeve is on fire." And the sous chef said, "Chef, I believe you are right." It was so calm. So there, obviously it's not everyone, but talk about the triggers that the Chef Apprentice School for the Arts in Nashville, one of the many, you know, cooking schools, has a piece, Why Chefs Are Such Jerks, Part One. And they talk about some of the stresses, you know, that every dish has to have perfection. It is hot. It is crowded. It is, you know, those kinds of triggers. It's not excusing someone's behavior, but what are the pressures on chefs and chef owners?
I think the first thing is the pressure on a famous chef is intense. I mean, in terms of, I'm not making excuses for anybody,
right?
But in terms of the internal pressure that any chef feels, in terms of when they have name recognition and they have responsibilities to a big operation, it creates a lot of pressure. You're under the microscope every day, and you're only as good as your last meal, and people don't forgive any kind of mistake.
Yeah.
So the customer doesn't they don't forgive it. And then there's always another deal. There's always another piece of real estate. And there's awards and accolades, which are very competitive and very, very highly sought after. So those things are the things that create. And, you know, honestly, you're working a lot of hours. Most chefs are working 80 hours a week. I'm talking about stars. You know, when you're talking about chef stars, they're working 80 hours a week. They are pulled in a lot of different directions, and it creates a lot of stress.
And a lot of it is all night, which has made it, you know, Jody Adams talks about that. It's tough for women who are having children.
Yeah, I mean, the career path for women, you know, who want to be a successful chef, to be able to rise to the top, is not conducive to having a family.
Yeah. Look, there are some terrific books, Becoming a Chef, The Soul of a Chef, The Journey Toward Perfection, which says a lot right there, Michael Ruhman's book. And a part of that, we're reminded, cooks are now chefs, chefs are celebrities, food magazines, TV networks, restaurants as famous as Broadway shows. And what used to be the labor of the lower classes is fashionable and, as you said, unbelievably competitive. But here you are at Centralina, all female. First of all, is that a reaction to having come up in the male-dominated industry? And is it different, ultimately?
Yes. I think, you know, I spent a good part of my career having to fight to get my voice heard. And so what I didn't want was to have my own restaurant and to be having those types of power struggles on a daily basis. Yeah. You know, I didn't want to have to deal with that. I did not do this by design, though. I mean, I interviewed many people, but it just happened to be that the people who were hired were women. I don't have all women. I have my senior management team is all women, and then I have two male male managers who just recently came on board. It's also not so easy on my female managers. I mean, they're also in a position of power in the dining room, and I think sometimes even customers don't understand that they're the general manager or they're the sommelier, or I think they think that they're hostess. You know, there's a lot of things that go on in this. But in terms of being able to drive success, we've created a restaurant where people feel comfortable about who they are, that goes for the front and the back of the house. And one thing that people can take away from this is that women are a good investment. Women don't have as many issues with some of the things we're seeing now. Women can be excellent managers. They can be very empathetic. They can drive consensus. So I impart a large part of our success to having that type of environment where my employees are devoted to the company and they feel a part of what we're doing, and they don't feel like they're disrespected in any way. I think there's this sense that, you know, the only people that have problems with this are in the industry are women. And I think that's a really gross understatement, because I think if you talk to employees, they all want a normal work environment. You know, they all want to be treated with respect. No matter the sex, nobody wants to be degraded. Nobody wants to be told that they're a piece of crap or thrown out of the kitchen or those kinds of things. It just happens to be that those are the cultures in most restaurants.
That's Amy Brandwine, not in hers. She's chef and owner of Centralina in Washington, D.C. Amy, thank you. Chef, thank you.
Thank you.
Have you heard of Nextdoor? It's a social network founded in 2010 that connects you to your physical neighborhood. It just raised about $75 million in funding, putting its value at around $1.5 billion, according to TechCrunch. For our View from the Top conversation, we're joined from San Francisco by co-founder and CEO Nirav Tolia. And Nirav, where did the idea for Nextdoor come from?
It was the summer of 2010. A couple of co-founders and I in Silicon Valley were looking around at the world of social networks and noticing that Facebook was amazing for communicating with friends. Twitter was amazing for following interesting people. LinkedIn was very effective at connecting us with colleagues. There wasn't a social network to connect with people right outside our front doors. There wasn't a local social network. And we believe that our local lives are some of the most important communities of them all. And that was the inspiration for the company.
Well, you say there isn't a local social network. I have to say, I haven't used Nextdoor yet, but I use something very similar on Facebook. And there's a community group for my local neighborhood, and it does a lot of the same kinds of things. Why would somebody need to use Nextdoor instead of just using a group on Facebook?
Well, there are Facebook groups for all kinds of things, whether it's communicating with folks in your neighborhood or following your favorite rock band or your sports team, etc. Nextdoor is purpose-built from the ground up for the neighborhood. To join Nextdoor, you provide your address, and we verify that you actually live in the neighborhood. All of the content is private. And so it's something that takes what you're experiencing on Facebook to the next level.
One of the things that I've noticed and have been very impressed by in my community bulletin board is that every time somebody loses their dog, three comments down, somebody says, oh, yeah, I've got him. He's on Third Street. You know, this is something that you have seen a lot of on Nextdoor, that lost dogs get found.
We see dozens of lost dogs that are found every day. In fact, we see missing children that are found using Nextdoor. And so this idea that you can tap into the power of your neighborhood, that's a very powerful concept. And now in almost 90% of American neighborhoods, over 160,000 neighborhoods that are using Nextdoor, we see these kinds of inspirational stories every day.
I was reading that in one case, a Dallas woman was able to get a liver transplant because of Nextdoor.
There are really inspirational things that happen when neighbors come together. And it typically is the case that when there is a neighbor in need and that neighbor asks for help, it's amazing the kindness of strangers. A woman was looking for a donor, and so she posted on Nextdoor, and there was a neighbor who knew someone, and ultimately she found a liver, and everything worked out the way it was supposed to.
How do you determine the boundaries of a neighborhood at Nextdoor? For example, if somebody lives in New York City, in Manhattan, how do you decide what the community that they're in is?
It's a great question, and frankly was one of the most difficult product features that we were required to build because, again, when you join Nextdoor, you give us your address, you verify that you live at that address, and then we put you in a neighborhood. And the neighborhood has real boundaries, which means that because all the neighborhoods have private discussions, if you're outside of those boundaries, you don't get access to that conversation. So you can imagine that these boundaries are very important to people. We thought for a long time that maybe we could find an information source, maybe a directory or a canon of information that would give us neighborhood boundary information, maybe even Google Maps. It turns out it didn't exist anywhere. And so we took a very kind of internet approach, really inspired by something like Wikipedia. And we said, what if we gave our members the tools to help us define the boundaries? What if we gave them certain criteria, like the neighborhood boundary has to be of a certain size, but within that, you can draw almost a free-form shape, and we'll use technology to snap that free-form shape into what looks like a neighborhood boundary. And in that way, we will rely on our members not just for the boundaries, but for the names of the neighborhoods themselves.
How do you make money?
Yes, we do have to make money. We're a social network, and while it's a free service and was from day one and will always be free for members, we've always believed that there's a tremendous opportunity not just to connect neighbors to neighbors, but to connect neighbors to local businesses as well. We provide a platform for local businesses to connect with the people that they want to serve in local communities. And whether that's something straightforward like an ad in the newsfeed, the same way that you might see one on Facebook, but in our case, it's going to be from a local business or from a national business that's doing business locally, or whether it's from a real estate agent, these are ways that not only we can make money and create a sustainable business, they're ways that we can give a voice to local businesses that really have been left behind in this internet revolution.
Let me just go back to the very beginning and what you were talking about for the reason that you wanted to create Nextdoor. And that is that, you know, we should be communicating with the people in our own neighborhood. Why do we need a social network for that? Why can't we just go outside and talk to our neighbors?
It's a great question. And the reality is we don't need Nextdoor to be involved with our neighborhood. But Nextdoor can be a great assistance. It can be a great tool. It can be a great icebreaker to do those things. We think the most successful Nextdoor interaction is one where you've run into someone online, but you use the conversation on Nextdoor to meet them in the real world. And that's how we're different. It's this online to offline component that makes the company very unique.
That's Nirav Tolia, who is the co-founder and CEO of Nextdoor. Nirav, thanks for joining us.
Thanks again for having me.